And now, Talk Radio 760 KFMB presents It's Your Money, Not Theirs, with your hosts Richard Musio and Joe Vecchio. Now, here are Richard and Joe.
Thank you, Justin, for getting us on the air here. This is the premier edition of It's Your Money, Not Theirs. I am your co-host and announcer, Joe Vecchio, and it's such a pleasure to be here and an honor. This signal, for people who may not know, reaches all the way up to Los Angeles County and beyond on in the evenings. So that gives an advantage even over FM radio, believe it or not. But without any further delay, the real central figure in this program is Richard Musio, and I'm going to toss to him right now to get into his life and career and the philosophy behind this show.
Thank you, Joe. And actually, I'm not actually the real centerpiece of this show today. We have a very special guest that we're going to get to in a minute. But again, I'm Richard Musio. I am a CPA, and my specialty is working with family offices. I'm known as the family office guy, so I work with very high net worth families. And some of the things we're going to be talking about on this show, or you might say the subtitles are, well, number one would be what your stockbroker and what Wall Street don't want you to know. But this is not a protest show, by the way. It's not a protest show. And then the second subtitle would be how are America's wealthiest families investing their money and how are they reducing their investment risk? Because a lot of smaller, shall we say, investors now have access to some of these things that America's wealthier families are doing. And that's for later shows, because this is going to be a very interesting show because of who our special guest is, and that would be Mr. Bill Lirak, and he is known as the king of the class action lawsuit. And we've got some very interesting things to talk about with Bill, but I wanted to try to put into perspective, and I'm going to ask him the same question, his career and some of the things we're going to talk about. And here's my story. I am, as I mentioned, a CPA, and I started my career at Arthur Andersen. But I was only there for 2 weeks because the gentleman who recruited me out of college at University of San Diego on my second Friday there said, hey, Richard, we're leaving the firm. My buddy Dan and I had to start our own firm on Monday. Do you want to join us? I said, sure. But I've always sort of liked Arthur Andersen since I started there. And Mr. Lirak is of course, because of his class action experience, recovered over $7 billion for Enron investors. But of course, Arthur Andersen was heavily involved in all of the litigation that went on surrounding Enron. And so he is credited, maybe fairly, maybe not, with putting Arthur Andersen out of business. I don't know if that's accurate or not, but certainly the Enron involvement did put Arthur Andersen out of business. So as a CPA, that sort of bothers me because I've always been very loyal to Arthur Andersen. On the other hand, this would be the other side of the coin. My aunt, well, late aunt, she passed away about 6 years ago. Her next door neighbor at her assisted living home in Rancho Bernardo was a woman named Mildred. And Mildred, at one point, owned a lot of Enron stock. In fact, her stockbroker basically had her in Enron and nothing else. And that's sort of unconscionable. We'll be talking about those topics later as the show moves along during the weeks. But the point is, she had maybe $200,000 invested in Enron. It was a really sweet ride. She was maybe up to $500,000, $600,000. And then one day, it all came crashing down, and Mildred had absolutely nothing left except maybe $20,000 of other stuff that her stockbroker had stuck into her account. And of course, her fear was that she was going to have to be taken in by family, or even worse, maybe go to a Medi-Cal facility because she was broke. And her most important desire, Mildred's most important desire, was to, shall we say, live out the rest of her life independently and not be the ward of the state or a burden on her family. And when all was said and done, the class action suit against Enron, which recovered over $7 billion. She got back not her entire $200,000 investment, but I think a little bit over half. It was maybe $120,000. And she was able to live her life out, shall we say, independently and not see her worst fears realized. So it's difficult for me to put Mr. Lirak's career in perspective because on the one hand, my Arthur Andersen background, on the other hand, I saw the extreme benefits that this whole process of the class action lawsuit, how this benefited my aunt's next-door neighbor, Mildred. So I guess, Bill, my first question to you is, how do you put your career into perspective, given all that it involved?
Well, Joe and Richard, listen, congratulations on your new show. I'm sure it's going to be a source of good, useful information for investors and people, and will be a big success. So
thank
best
you.
Of luck to you.
Thank you.
Boy, I'm glad that the story had a modestly happy ending, and we were able to make that recovery. And the lawsuits that we brought over the years did recover a lot of money for defrauded investors, and we think it helped try to shape corporate behavior in a better way. We worked hard, and we had a lot of grateful clients. As you know, we made some mistakes, and we paid a price for that. But I'm proud of the work we did. And by the way, Richard, I think it'd be more accurate to say Arthur Andersen put Arthur Andersen out of business. It was Arthur Andersen's conduct in becoming so implicated in WorldCom and Enron that really brought down that firm.
Yeah, I mean, I'd agree with that assessment, but it was certainly the Enron debacle that finished them off, without question.
Yeah.
What percentage of your lawsuits were based on insider trading? And for those in the audience who may not know what insider trading is, maybe you could explain what that is.
Well, one of the problems in the market, and Richard, I know, is very familiar with this, is it's an uneven game. The corporate insiders, especially the corporate officers, have a big advantage. They have access to what we call market-sensitive or market-important information that other investors simply don't have. Now, the law prohibits them from profiting from that by selling or buying while in possession of non-public information. But unfortunately, due to real severe regulatory failures and cutbacks in recent years, the bars against insider trading have been eroded. There's a lot of insider trading. In Enron, the insider sold over $150 million worth of their stock before the crash came. And that was, if you remember that Mazzoli, the CEO of the savings and loan Countrywide, I mean, this is a guy who sold $600, $700 million worth of his stock in the year or two before this thing blew up and left investors holding the bag. It makes for rotten markets, it undercuts investors' confidence, but it helped the lawsuits when we brought it and exposed it because they were embarrassed by it, and they didn't like getting caught.
And the other argument is if the SEC had been doing their job, there may not be as much need for a firm like yours recovering all of that. I think I read in your book that there were many years where your firm recovered much more than the SEC.
Well, remember, look, the SEC was at one time a magnificent regulatory agency and a real example of the good things that a good independent regulatory agency can do in America. But unfortunately, it got captured by the industries it regulates, Wall Street and the corporate world. Its resolve to vigorously enforce the laws and regulations was badly eroded. And I think the SEC has to bear a lot of blame for the, especially the last financial crisis. And it's a lesson that we're having trouble learning in this country. But if you curtail the regulation of the financial markets severely, just given the nature of the markets and the people in those markets, you're going to get an upsurge in fraud. And it's innocent people like Richard's mother who pay the price, not the insiders who keep what they take.
So my understanding is you recovered about $45 billion between all of the class actions. I mean, Enron and everything else added together. Is that a fairly accurate assessment?
It's the right number, but you say it wrong when you say you recovered. It wasn't just me. I had a tremendous group of partners and a wonderful law firm. We had, I think we may have had 400 lawyers at our peak size. We had offices all over the United States. I had tremendous mentors who helped train me in the business, but also tremendous young people, very idealistic, very hardworking. So these recoveries weren't the work or the result of one person.
Right. You were more like the supreme allied commander of, because this is a huge force of a legal force that went forward when you're a lead attorney like that.
So. But Bill, I heard when you would go into settlement conferences, you would be greatly outnumbered. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, it was the nature of the kinds of cases that we brought. Oftentimes you had law firms as defendants, accounting firms, investment banking firms, the board of directors, who knows? So there were lots and lots of defendants. They have a lot of money. They have big, powerful lawyers. And lots of them. And many, many times, it was sort of fun, to be honest. You'd sit in a giant conference room, one of these conference room tables. You wonder how they ever even built it, much less got it in the conference room. It was so big, and it would be surrounded by 15, 20, 25 lawyers. But you know what? If you had the facts on your side and you had the good documents, just doesn't really matter how many of them there are. You just have to weave your way through it.
I believe one of your law partners, Michelle Ciccarelli, told me that one of the final Enron conferences occurred at the Peninsula Hotel in Chicago. And there were about four of you and about 180 of them.
Well, that case was, we have a Latin expression, sui generis, one of a kind. but look, in a sense, Joe, it was only evidence of how horrible the fraud was. I mean, you know, it's amazing. We have short memories of Americans. We had a couple-year period there between WorldCom and Enron and Tyco and a whole host of other companies that I could mention. American investors and pension funds who are big investors in these equities lost maybe as much as $14 trillion. You know, the guys on Wall Street didn't lose $14 trillion. The chairman of Merrill Lynch, the guy who got booted out, took $250 million down to Florida. Jerry Warner, who put the worst merger in the history of the world together, Time Warner and AOL, he walks away with $760 million and is living in, you know, some friendship
villa.
Village or whatever it is up in California. I'm just saying it's unfair in the way it breaks down. The insiders walk away with too much and the ordinary people
get
stiff.
Well, maybe that's why some Americans are out on the streets. But let's take a little break. We'll be back with Mr. Bill Lirak, who recovered over $45 billion in his illustrious career. We'll be back right after this break. I picked this up. Does everyone remember this great theme song, Henry Mancini, Peter Gunn? Love it, love it. Hey, we have to thank one of our premier sponsors, Lestat's Coffee House, a great little place in Normal Heights is the original site, and they have one now in University Heights. Always packed open 24-7, 365, great coffee. Please go visit Lestat's. You're going to love it if you can find a seat. And if you'd like to call in tonight, if we have some time, the toll-free number is 800-760-KFMB, 800-760-5362. And back to you, Richard.
So, Bill, I got in the mail on Friday. This was like divine intervention. I got this piece of correspondence. It's called Notice of QS Communications Remission. And it says that I, having once been a stockholder of QS, am eligible to receive or to participate in a recovery against Mr. Joseph Natio of $44 million. Okay? So $44 million has been recovered by the Justice Department, and there's a law firm that's serving as the administrator of the remission process. And I received this notice because my records indicate that I was a shareholder. However, in big, bold print, it says, although you establish eligibility for participation in the plaintiff class, you are not eligible for a remission distribution because your pro rata distribution amount would not exceed the de minimis amount of $10 established by the Department of Justice. Now, this says two things. Number one, it says I'm broke because I've got three teenagers, so I couldn't afford to buy very much QS. But beyond that, it brings up the big picture question. Are small investors better off now than they were 5 years ago, or are they worse off now than they were, let's say, 5 years ago in 2006 or 2007 in terms of being protected by these kinds of ripoffs by large companies?
Well, unfortunately, I think the securities markets have become more speculative, more volatile, more fraud-infested, and polluted by insider trading. And I think that is working to the great disadvantage of small investors. You know, the myth of strong, positive stock market returns over time being all but inevitable for investors has just been completely disproven over the last 15 years. The market hasn't gone very much of any way, and there's been a lot of really significant and bad losses. Now, why is that? Well, in significant part, it's because we tore down the regulatory structure that was meant to protect us, ordinary people, investors, from the very sharp, avaricious, and ambitious people on Wall Street and in the corporate community. The SEC badly cut back. Now, look, this settlement that you mentioned against Mr. Nascio involves alleged insider trading. And here you have a situation where I think people who were familiar with this, there was a criminal conviction. You wonder why the recovery is so modest. And then as Richard read, it's so small that he wouldn't even get $10. And that, I think, undermines the confidence of people in the system. If you're going to have a private litigation system to try to regulate the markets and supplement the government, which won't do a good job because it's captured by the industries, make it a fair fight. Have the fight take place on a level playing field so that the people who are willing to stand up for the defrauded investors have a chance to make a recovery like we made in Enron, which was a very large recovery and still only a part of the damages. The field of private enforcement, that is lawsuits by lawyers like I used to bring and others, has been crippled by the corporate powers in the courts who've cut back on the ability to have a remedy. So what happens if you have an inadequate remedy? You get a cheap settlement, the people don't get much, and it doesn't serve the system, either for deterrence or compensation.
Well, I could have used my $9.12. I could have gotten a little stats and enjoyed some great live music and, you know, bought a couple
But you
of
know,
cups
Richard,
of
it's funny. I got letters from people over the years who got $9, and you know what they would say? It doesn't amount to much, but it means something to me that somebody cared enough to fight for me.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
There is part of it, too.
So there's this thing called Sarbanes-Oxley. Those of us in accounting call it SOX, and it's a regulatory, shall we say, well, it was a bill many years ago that was designed to, shall we say, add protection to investors by placing more responsibility on CPAs and auditors who were, shall we say, doing the audits or the reviews of these companies. Given the economic mess that this country's in, there are rumors that with regard to whatever, let's call it reconciliation of our economic situation that comes out in the form of new legislation, that Sarbanes-Oxley might actually be, removed of some of its teeth. What are your impressions about Sarbanes-Oxley? Has it worked? Has it not? And where do you think it might go?
I've heard those rumors that the administration might trade curtailing Sarbanes-Oxley for the stimulus bill or employment bill. I think I'm going to give an answer that might surprise you a little bit, Richard. I am not enthusiastic about the impact of Sarbanes-Oxley, and I'll tell you what I thought was wrong with it, and I think it's what's wrong with Dodd-Frank. Attempts to legislate and regulate the financial world, corporate world, and the banks become so lobbied so heavily by such powerful interests that even if you get remedial legislation behind the scenes, it's shaped in a way that the industry can live with it. And my problem with Sarbanes-Oxley is it's too much check-the-box kind of auditing. Now, you were an accountant. You remember what you learned. Fair presentation. There are general core accounting principles. Full disclosure. Fair presentation. Substance over form. You don't need a lot of boxes to check if you've got an independent auditor who's skeptical, who is applying those core principles, but the core principles have been lost.
Yeah, and my problem with Sarbanes-Oxley was more of a personal one as a CPA. It made a lot of young people who came into my profession do a lot of brain-dead work, as I call it, and they didn't have much quality of life. It was even worse than tax season, I think, for these poor young people who had to do all of this, shall we say, check-the-box stuff. Anyway, we're going to break.
Yeah, we're taking a break
I've already ripped Sarbanes-Oxley. No apology to all the CPAs out there.
Hey, when we come back, we'll get into pensions with Bill. That's what y'all want to hear about. So we'll be back right after this break. This is a great song, too. This is Hawaii Five-0. Welcome back to It's Your Money, Not Yours.
Not theirs.
Not theirs, thank you, with your illustrious host, Richard Muzio, and our terrific guest, Bill Lirak. Richard, take it away.
So, Bill, I heard you speak at an event recently, and I'm going to ask you a question about that. And we also want to announce that Bill's going to be presenting in public on Thursday, November 17th, somewhere in Delmar Heights. I don't think the venue has been decided yet, but it's an event sponsored by Advanced Practice Advisors, www.apa-ria.com, who's also one of the sponsors of our show. They are not stockbrokers. They are registered investment advisors, so they take, shall we say, a much more independent and objective direction towards assisting people with meeting their financial goals. But Bill's going to be speaking about the pension mess, which is going to be my next question. But I heard Bill speak about the pension mess at an event on September 1st. It was at STAR San Diego. STAR, S-T-A-R, stands for Strategic Trusted Advisors Roundtable. And that's a very interesting group here in San Diego, founded by Russ Davis and Carl Sheeler, that has grown from 4 members only 2 years ago to over 450 members of very, shall we say, experienced, most of us have gray hair, professional advisors in the San Diego community, attorneys, accountants, insurance specialists, wealth managers. And Bill actually did a very interesting presentation. It was actually covered by Bloomberg News. First time anybody actually flew over 2,000 miles to attend a STAR event. Had over 100 attendees there, and we heard a great discussion of the real mess that pensions are in this country, in particular, public pensions. So, Bill, could you touch a little bit on the pension situation, particularly as it relates to, shall we say, the public sector?
Well, of the many financial challenges facing our nation right now, the mess with the public pension funds and to some extent even the private corporate funds has to rank right up there with the worst of them. It's a tragic example of a good idea gone bad. We put in place a public pension system, public employees of the states and counties, school teachers throughout the United States to take care of these people with a pension when they retired. The money was supposed to be carefully invested by a board of trustees. And unfortunately, the Wall Street money managers captured these funds. They lobbied for the repeal of laws that restricted the investments that pension funds could be in to high-quality bonds for the most part. And before you know it, the Wall Street banks have their hooks in these pension funds. They're charging them in the aggregate hundreds of millions of dollars of fees every year to invest in this volatile, fraud-infested stock market that we now face, and a lot of other esoteric, risky investments. And the bottom line today is these pension funds are at least $3 to $4 trillion in deficit or short of what they need to pay their promises to the retirees. It's producing political conflict. It's going to produce generational conflict. And we have to find a solution for this because the problem is not going away. It is literally a big time bomb sitting there, and that fuse doesn't have very much time left on it.
And I think the point that a lot of people miss, though, is how did we get here? Everyone thinks it's because of the economic downturn, but...
It's not, Joe. The fact of the matter is 15, 18 years ago, most of these big public funds were fully funded or close enough that it didn't make a big difference. Today, these funds are only 50% funded. It's money that's been lost in the... I'm going to use the term junk, that Wall Street has sold these funds, the collateralized debt obligations, these worthless packages of mortgages that were put together, speculative raw real estate. And what I think people need to appreciate, remember, these are what we call fiduciary investments. This is the life savings of working people. Now, trustees are supposed to act in a cautious, careful manner when they are fiduciaries. And how this got turned around to where these huge pension funds are putting money in these crazy Wall Street products that are patched together. It's really a sad story. And what's the saddest part of all? The solution will inflict more pain on the victims, not the perpetrators. It's just not fair.
Well, I think if one looks at the history of, well, just call it pension funds in general, way back when, before I was even born, basically pensions were only allowed to invest in bonds. So they were very, very safe investments. And then, of course, all kinds of things changed. I made a comment about a year ago to somebody who used to sit on a pension board. And this pension wasn't, well, it still isn't doing very well. And I made the sarcastic comment that the people on the pension board decided it was their job to try to beat certain investment return benchmarks as opposed to it being their job to make sure pensioners got their pension. And I guess that just goes to your point about the kinds of things that people or trustees or boards were investing in. And of course, this person was offended by my comment, but I think it was true.
No, I think it was. And look, there's no question that Wall Street deserves the primary share of the blame. But the boards of trustees of these funds are to be criticized as well. There's not been enough attention to being careful. And let me, you're so perceptive, Richard. There's a pension fund called the Western States Teamsters Pension Fund. And of course, the immediate use of the term Teamsters always makes people get queasy because of the history. But do you know that that fund has always been invested almost all in bonds? And that fund today is one of the safest, most secure, and fully funded pension funds in America, proving Richard's point. Life savings monies of workers have no business in these highly speculative, risky investments in a fraud-infested market. It's wrong. And no solution that Governor Braun or anybody else proposes is ever going to fix this problem so long as we allow the Wall Street money managers to own these funds, take huge fees out of them, and use them as dumping grounds for the products that they sell.
I do want to talk about Governor Brown's proposal, but not quite yet. I think one interesting thing to me is there has been a definite trend in the pension arena over the last 15 to 20 years. And companies usually say this has to do with them having to remain profitable. So they're shifting the burden of funding retirement away from the company for its employees and over to the employee. The 401k is what I'm talking about. And so many companies now, most of the retirement that somebody's getting is, shall we say, on their own volition. They're contributing to a 401k. My challenge with 401ks, though, is they're great for stockbrokers because you put money in every time you get paid. Call that twice a month or 26 times a year, 24 times a year. And in many cases, you can only take money out once or twice a year. And so I think the game is really rigged against the common or average employee with 401ks. But again, that's one of my prejudices. Any thoughts about that?
Well, the 401k scheme, to use that word in a non-pejorative way, has not been a big success. 401k investors suffered over $1 trillion of losses in the most recent market debacle. My own, it's anecdotal experience, was lots of phone calls from lots of wonderful people whose 401k money ended up in phone booths in Africa. I mean, one harebrained, you know, and I'm sorry, the fundamental error in the 401k is that it puts an individual, and Richard, you may disagree, but no matter how unsophisticated, in charge of his own investments, and he's going to be the prey for the fast buck artist or the unscrupulous broker. And I mean, imagine if all of our Social Security money had been put into 401k types of investments, which at one time was seriously discussed in this country.
Yeah, I know my 401k is now a 201k. be that as it may, I was also reading a fascinating article. This is just to follow up on your point in terms of unsophisticated investors. Obviously, a lot of these workers are, shall we say, under the age of 35, so they don't have a lot of experience with investing. But interestingly, a lot of the investors are between the ages of 60 and 65, and I was reading a fascinating article about how as you get older, your ability to make good financial decisions decreases. However, your confidence in making them increases, which is a really bad combination if there also happens to be a stockbroker in the room. And so I think I agree. The 401k has basically been a failure. We're going to talk about Jerry Brown soon, but I want to read what he proposed. This was about 2 days ago. I think it came out on Thursday. But he proposed, shall we say, a rather sweeping plan to change the public employee pension benefits here in the state of California. And if you haven't been reading the newspaper, it includes things like raising the retirement age to 67 for new employees, requiring state and local employees to pay more towards their retirement and health care. Now, that gets us back into this hybrid thing of a 401k. Also gets rid of some of these techniques that they use that allow people to put in sick time and other unused time into their plan called spiking. I don't know if this is going to be passed or not, but it's designed to save about $900 million annually. I know the state has about a $75 billion shortfall. I want to talk about that when we come back from the break. Again, it's your money, not theirs. You got that right, Jim?
I got it right. Thank you. I'm overcome with emotion. Back with It's Your Money, Not Theirs, and Richard's going to carry on with Bill Lirak. Welcome.
We are indeed. Before the break, I was asking Bill the question about Governor Brown's proposal to, shall we say, improve the rather dire pension situation in California. Again, it is predicted right now, or estimated, that the California public employees retirement system has $75 billion in unfunded future pension liabilities. And the state is also on the hook for an estimated $51.8 billion in unfunded retiree health care costs. So that's about $125 billion, not million, billion, or like Dr. Evil, gazillion, in unfunded pension and health care liabilities. What do you think of the governor's proposal, Bill?
Yeah, and those deficit numbers are just CalPERS. Remember, you have CalSTRS, the Teachers Fund, and the California Regents Fund, the University of California, which have huge, the same problem, same funding deficit. Look, it's a gigantic financial hole to try to fix. I think there's a lot to recommend. Look, something has to be done. The problem cannot be ignored. It's true that it seems unfair that the solution will weigh most heavily on the victims, but that's the way the world is sometimes. Wall Street, unfortunately, gets away with a lot of the stuff it does, and other people take the pain. We have to solve this problem. Getting rid of this spiking notion where pensions are goosed up based on unused vacation and last year bonuses, it's a very good idea. That's only fair. I think that the governor's plan seems to allow us to keep our promises to the already retired and long-term employees. Remember, I think public employees have to adjust to a emerging reality where the competitive economic disadvantage of public employment that historically justified very generous pensions may no longer exist in the real world. You know, the private sector has imploded in recent years. As you were saying, the defined benefit plan is leaving the private sector entirely. So public employees, I think, have to adjust to that reality, and there are going to be cutbacks. But look, you'll never solve the problem of the pension funds not having enough money if you continue to allow the Wall Street bankers to plunder the funds and lose the money in speculative investments. So I would say, look, maybe this is a bitter pill for the public employees to swallow. Maybe they better hold their nose and swallow it. But look, let's also reform how these plans are managed. Governor Brown wants two new independent directors on the CalPERS board. I think that's a very, very useful idea. But I'd prefer something that said, let's get back to bonds, let's get back to safe fixed income investments, and stop having Wall Street speculate with the life savings of our employees, and then send the bill to the taxpayers and the employees. Not right.
Why don't you mention the solution of your bond for the whole the nation?
Well, I wondered whether one solution might be this. The retirement funds desperately need an assured, safe return on the money that they now have, so it won't be all lost. The federal government desperately needs to borrow money to finance the deficits that we have and perhaps finance some of the spending programs that progressives believe will help generate economic growth. So why not solve those two problems at one time? Let's take the bulk of America's public pension fund money, have it invested in a new federal government retirement bond, tax-free, nice high rate of interest. It'll provide an assured safe rate of return to the funds. They can pay the pension promises they owe. We'll cut Wall Street out of the deal so they can stop plundering the funds. And maybe we can help finance the deficit and some economic growth. And if we could just get about 5 years of really good, strong economic growth, a lot of the problems we all sit around talking about all the time would go away.
Yeah, the administration in California wants to require all, that would be 100% of public employees, to contribute at least half of the annual cost of funding their pension benefits. That would be the 401k piece that I was alluding to. Presently, some employees do pay this much, but a lot of other employees pay nothing at all or just a little bit. In other words, the state is providing the entire benefit. I should say the taxpayers
yes.
are providing the entire benefit. Now, you know, Brown's plan is fairly ambitious. It's going to require approval, of course, from the legislature.
And the voters.
I know the there are union allied Democrats who are likely to balk at some of what he's proposing. And also fairly recently, he failed to win consensus on this issue with Republicans. So he not only has the Republicans he has to worry about, but the union allied Democrats.
And it's a sign of how serious this problem is that a progressive Democratic governor would propose such draconian solutions that's against the interests of one of his biggest supporting groups. And I have to give Brown some credit for that.
Well, unfortunately, we have to end it right there.
We have to remember to say thank you again, well, not only to Bill Lyrak, but also to Lestats.
Well, I'm going to do that. I'm going to thank Lestats for being one of our premier sponsors for the second half of the show. You can find them at Lestats.com. And also, next week, Paul Spitzer will be here to talk about the upcoming event with Bill. And a thank you to Craig Blanke, account executive at KFMB Extraordinaire, our board operator, Justin Hart, who's here from Michigan, only 5 years. And then, of course, the programming director, genius, if you don't believe, Dave Smith, thank him. If you don't believe he's a genius, just call his voicemail. It's right on there. And we'll see you next week. Thanks very much for tuning in. Hope you enjoyed it. This is Magnificent Seven, Bill. This is 1960 in honor of Bill Mazeroski. I'll talk about it later.